Is it on now?
Yeah.
Yes, good.
Thank you.
Good. I was just saying to His Holiness that we have a treat in store for us for this afternoon. He was appreciating the quotation at the top of the slide, God is love.
말해, 다들 영국 소년 소리지요스, 단단히 뭐라 답지에 쉬어야 돼. 근데 단단히 책디, 감사하고 돈 안 주고 선수.
So what a wonderful morning we had together just now. Matthew, thank you so much for your contribution. It was such a joy and a privilege for all of us to watch the interaction between Your Holiness and Matthew and to learn from that. Just beautiful. Thank you, Roshi, also for moderating it. Our time together is racing by, Your Holiness. We have only two more presentations this week. It's hard to believe that it's almost over. At this time tomorrow, we will begin pooling our impressions of what we've learned from this week, what it may signify, where it may be leading us, each one of us as an individual, and that includes the participants and all the witnesses as well, I believe, and all of us as a group. These questions will stay with us for a long time, I suspect. I think we all do sense that this experience is changing us in ways that may not yet be completely clear. We've certainly had wonderfully sophisticated and informative discussions of the human brain. I know that I go home with a much deeper understanding of that and also a much greater curiosity to continue to pursue a deeper understanding of that. And also wonderful discussions, deep insights from the Buddhist and Indian, as you would have us say, wisdom traditions, through words and metaphors, visual images, careful distinctions. We need those too. We need both. Yes. And we had examples, of course, of those from Shimpala and Matthew. We've seen what we might call, I think, the two-edged sword of the brain's plasticity. So it invites optimism, this discovery that the brain can change, because it means that we can train ourselves to be kinder, more compassionate, less self-involved, to move from what was called the biased perception, the biased compassion for those closest to us, the mother's warm-heartedness towards her baby, to the unbiased compassion that Your Holiness said yesterday is so much stronger because it extends to all living beings, but that also takes cultivation, takes attention, takes careful work. But it may be our only salvation at this point, that work, that unbiased compassion on this fragile planet that we are more and more aware we all must share in a better way. So that's the optimistic view of neuroplasticity, that we have this ability to change. But the brain's plasticity makes it susceptible also to being hijacked. That's a metaphor that the neuroscientists like to use. And we understand much better now how those processes work, how devilishly clever they are, in a sense, those processes, locking the neurochemical and neurological hijackers of the brain, described to us by Kent and Nora and others, trapping the addict in what seems like almost an iron cage after taking away all of his natural defenses, as Matthew described, and using them against him. So that left us last night, I think, in something of a pessimistic place with respect to addiction. But then Matthew this morning gave us the beginnings of a more optimistic pathway out. While only some people find themselves in this cage, I think we also have said this week that our compulsive nature is there to some degree in all of us, that it extends across a continuum. It's an essential part, as Nora told us, of the equipment that enables we humans to survive in the world as a species. So it's there, and we must live with it. Jinpa, when he spoke, invoked the image of the little children, those sweet little children who were struggling so mightily not to eat their marshmallows. He reminded us of their faces. I think we can all conjure them up. And he asked us to imagine another element in the picture. What if a voice was being transmitted into their room telling them how delicious those marshmallows were, describing how they would taste, how they would feel, how satisfying they would be. You need this marshmallow now, the voices would say, like the devil sitting on their shoulder. And that is our condition, Jinpa reminded us, in our modern consumer culture, surrounded by a wild and ever-changing proliferation of these voices, these messages that are designed cleverly and with great sophistication to ratchet up our desires and our cravings, to use them against us, against our better natures, by inflating our sense of self, by playing on our insecurities, by feeding our delusions about the things that will truly bring us inner peace. When Jinpa told that story and suggested that other image, it reminded me of a field, of a tradition of writing on something that has been called the degradation of the cultural environment. An analogy to the worries we have about what's happening to our physical environment because of our inattention and our carelessness. The thought that similarly we are degrading the cultural environment on which we depend also for our sustenance. And the people who coined that term pointed out something important, which was from the beginning of time, we humans have communicated through stories to our young about who they are, about what is important, about how to make sense of the world through stories. And in our modern consumer society, for the first time and for the most part, those stories are being told to our children by people whose sole purpose is to sell them something. And that changes the whole dynamic. So it may not be too much of a stretch to draw this analogy. I wonder if we might say that just as the plasticity of the brain is being recruited to unwholesome purposes in the case of addiction, as we heard, so too is the culture, the wider culture, as Vivica spoke of yesterday, being recruited to unwholesome purposes in the case of advertising and marketing and consumerism, converting our natural desires that we have as human beings into greed, into wanting more and more and more, creating very serious problems for us all. So the question then that we've been discussing in a way all week long, sometimes specifically with respect to addiction, sometimes in this much broader way that I'm suggesting, is what sorts of defenses can we mount against those powerful external forces? How can we resist? How can we convert, as Your Holiness said this morning, greed to generosity, fear to compassion? How do we do that in this field of all these messages? Well, Mathieu gave us a wonderfully clear and cogent answer from the Buddhist perspective. And Your Holiness has mentioned several times this week that there are interesting parallels as well from the Christian contemplative traditions. So today is really our chance to see those two traditions side by side. And this afternoon, we turn to the Christian tradition. Our guide is Wendy Farley. She's professor of religion at Emory University. She's chair of theological studies there. She studied Western theology and philosophy, and she has a special interest in contemplative texts, and especially early texts, very early texts, by contemplative women. That's a particular specialty of hers, the Beguines, and early monastics, desert ascetics from the 4th to the 7th century. So she's going to speak to us about two forms of desire and about how these early mystics understood and worked with them. So Wendy, with that, thank you.
Thank you. I'm very happy and grateful to be here. Thank you.
I think recently in Emory.
Emory.
You there?
Yes, yes. I saw you a week or so ago. We had a lot of fun together, in case you don't remember. A lot of you may know about Christianity, and you may know it in its more toxic elements. And many of you, if you're Western, have fled to Buddhism for relief. And I can sympathize with that. I'm going to
talk. And equally, many Easterners, even from Buddhist countries, also becoming Christian. There are also such
things. Okay, well, that's good. Goes both ways. I'm going to talk today about forms of Christianity that are somewhat less well known and draw on two literatures in particular. The literature of the desert ascetics, the Amas and Abbas that went into the desert. They were very intoxicated with the idea of love. And they went into the desert to learn how to love. So they became very good psychologists.
The
desert fathers, Egypt, so what are these words, Abba and Amma? Are they
father and mother?
That's right.
But, yeah.
That's right.
What language?
Greek.
Greek.
Oh, it's Tibetan. Baba, Amma.
It's very similar to Tibetan.
Mm-hmm. It was like saying master, like my Amma, you know.
I call him. Easiest way.
Someone is wondering why there is this kind of, you know, commonality of using pa, some form of pa or pi or fa, and ma for mother across the languages. Mm-hmm. He's wondering whether it's because it's the easiest thing on the tongue.
And then, most important is self. So, I. One word. So, except Japanese, as far as I know. Because
Watashi wa.
Four words.
Four syllables.
That's something unique. Say jagel kare jin, me. Or self, o. Nga, o. Kasa jagel kare kasa.
Ham.
The other literature I'm looking at is the women contemplatives, and in particular a movement called the Beguines. The Beguines were women who did not want to be enclosed nuns, and they didn't want to marry. They wanted to.
That's a
Beguine, sorry. Oh.
They wanted to carve out a way of life where they could live in the world but be contemplatives. So they tended to be care for the sick, be care for the grieving, but But they wanted to study and they wanted to become contemplative adepts. The greatest of these was burned at the stake in 1310 because the Christian church didn't appreciate their contributions. So that movement was shut down. But it did produce, I think, some of the most profound and beautiful of the texts in Christianity on contemplative practice. So, this is a quotation from Isaac of Nineveh, and it expresses what Christians in these traditions wish for, what they desire. What is a merciful heart? A heart burning for all creation, for human beings, for birds, for animals, and even for demons. It cannot endure hearing or seeing any injury or slight sorrow to anything in creation. Because of this, great compassion offers tearful prayers that every being be guarded and forgiven. So these are practitioners who want to remove all obstacles so that this could be their whole consciousness. I'm going to talk about this in three major steps. Christians, at least in these lineages, understand desire in two forms. I think Buddhists might say a wholesome and unwholesome form. So I'm going to talk about that. Evagrius Ponticus puts it this way. Whatever a person loves, they will desire with all their might. What they desire, they strive to lay hold of. So from this perspective, reforming desire is the fundamental spiritual practice because you become what you desire. So I'm going to distinguish these two forms of desire. In using the Greek, healthy desire or religious desire, they use the word eros for. Eros also can mean other things, but in this tradition, it means a kind of healthy desire. And there's different words that were used for distorted eros desire.
Eros. Eros.
I'm going to talk a little bit about, for me, what's intriguing, and particularly this week, it's only been made more intriguing, is the way the analysis of desire in these traditions seems to really map on some of the things that are said about the structure of addiction. So I'm going to just make a few comments about the utility for this psychology for thinking about addiction, both in the sense of substance abuse, but in the sense of the way our minds are addicted to negative patterns. And then I'm going to conclude by outlining very briefly supporting practices Christians have used to restore healthy desire. Most briefly, healthy desire, or eros, is a kind of joyfulness, which is self-emptying. It's a desire for the good of others. It's self-forgetful. It moves away from the self. It's like an arrow that's shot away from the self toward reality. And reality means, for Christians, the unconditional love of the divine, and it means the reality of the world as it really is. In healthy desire, the object of desire is healthy. And from a Christian point of view, the object of desire would be God. And St. John of the Cross writes, I abandoned myself and forgot myself, laying my face on my beloved. All things ceased. I went out from myself, leaving my cares forgotten among the lilies. St. John wrote this when he was in prison being ritually tortured by his brothers for his reform movement. But in his prison cell, he nonetheless wrote some of the most beautiful spiritual literature in the Christian tradition. And it's about the way love of God is self-transcending. You forget yourself. And in your self-forgetfulness is that there's great joy. So on the one hand, the object of desire is healthy, God. However, probably everyone here knows that there can be really unhealthy, terribly distorted, terribly destructive desires named God. I love God because he will punish my enemies. I love God because he'll give me lots of money. I love God because he upholds the systems that keep me in power. So you can have, in a sense, an object of desire named God that's very, very unhealthy.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
So a better way of saying it is perhaps to say that a healthy object of desire would be love itself. And so we have Hodwick saying, I would have given myself all to love, my whole self, with the devotion of all my powers, so I could live love with love. So her desire is to empty herself, so she becomes simply an open space for the flow of divine love. That would be her desire. This is going to be least interesting to anybody but me. But
and Arthur.
And Arthur. But from a contemplative point of view, this is the most important thing. And that is that in Eros, in religious Eros, it's not just that the object of desire changes, that I want a good object instead of a bad object. It's that the way I desire is completely different. That rather thinking of myself, I'm a self and I need something good, even a good thing like love, healthy desire annihilates that structure. So it's paradoxical because it's not a self wanting an object, even a good object, but it's some dimension of mind that is not structured by the ego. And that non-egoistic dimension of mind is yearning for reality. And in that sense, it's non-possessive. It's not, I don't want this good object. It's a desire to annihilate the very structure of egocentric desiring, even desire for something good. Marguerite Perret puts it this way, I am only that which God is in me and not some other thing. Therefore, I am not except what God is. And thus, all work of caritas, a word for love, is complete.
Deje deba bodan deje yuta de do shane ngal di go yus ngal di du du si si de
inzir me
inzir me be che ta deja da de deba bo ni bute ni me ke to ne kan da de le ji to ne chung bei na ta kun jo ta ni ta kun jo mo se re deje kun jo ta de ma sha bu chi.
So in Marguerite's way of putting it, I don't exist anymore. I have been annihilated. And in that annihilation, the work of love becomes complete. So that's not desiring a good object, but annihilating the structure.
Would you say it's like becoming it?
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. Now, some of you may have had the experience that that's not your ordinary way of living in the world. Our desire tends to be of a distorted form, or maybe of a mixed form, but certainly heavily shaped by distorted desire. And in unhealthy desire, desire gets rerouted back to the ego. It gets hooked into the ego. Matthew laid out very interesting, and Jinpala laid out very interesting kind of steps of that. The Christian tradition has lots of different ways of thinking about how that rerouting of the kind of natural and appropriate structure of desire gets hooked in this anguish-filled way. One way of thinking about it is to say that we're spiritual beings in a world like this and in bodies like this. And our bodies are subject to pain, and our minds are subject to pain. And because of that, we become very preoccupied with ourselves. If you're in that dentist office and the drill is in your tooth and you don't have Novocaine, and before you went in there, you were a kind and loving person and you cared about people and you were thinking all kinds of gracious thoughts. When the drill gets put on your tooth, all you can think about is your pain. And so all of your sweet thoughts about others disappear. Your mind is completely concentrated on pain. You might say from this point of view, the point of view of these writings, that's the human condition. There are moralistic versions of Christianity that put it in different ways. But in this lineage, you might say, living this kind of life in this kind of body with this kind of mind is so excruciatingly painful. Our consciousness just gets tied there. And it becomes very difficult to think outside of that. Just as if you're in the dentist's office, it's really hard to think outside of the pain you're in. So because of that, because of the painfulness and the vividness of my experience of myself and my own pain, and of course also my pleasure, others become kind of misty. So I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you, and I actually think you're all real and interesting and hope good things for you. But if I cut my finger, I wouldn't care that much about you. My whole consciousness would be about my finger. And I might intellectually recognize that this is not as important as most of the things going on in the world, but my consciousness would be totally there. And I would still remember you existed. I might care. But my vivid sense of reality would be on me. And so even if intellectually I granted that wasn't very realistic, nonetheless, the way my mind would work is I would be tied to my own experience. And your experience would be important, but not quite as important. It would be real, but it wouldn't be quite as real. So that is, in a sense, our condition. Now, in the distortion of desire, we desire, we're like this little kid. Our desire ceases to be a desire for the good of everyone and for the sweetness of divine presence. We desire our own happiness and we desire relief from our suffering. And we believe that things in the world will relieve the pain of our life and will give us pleasure. So in this, it's, I think, quite similar to Mathieu's analysis, namely, because of this distorted experience, we grant the world a kind of reality it simply doesn't have. And we hope to extract from it something it cannot give us. It cannot give us real relief, and it cannot give us ultimate happiness. And yet, we can't stop expecting it to do that. So in these ways, there are analogies with what it would, what substance abuse is like. So the object of desire becomes our happiness and the objects in the world which appear to have the power to give it to us. The structure of desire also change. So it's not just that there's a different object in these two forms of desire. There's a different structure. In distorted desire, I have a very strong experience of myself and of my own pain and of my own desire for goodness and happiness and pleasure. And I have a very strong sense of the world as exterior to me and in a certain way disconnected from me. It's not me. And so the things that I believe will relieve my pain and cause me pleasure, I want to possess them. I want to bring them into me and mine. So my desire is curved in on myself. And the things that seem to threaten me, I want to push away even farther. So this dualistic desire is inordinate. It gives things in the world powers that are inordinate. So something good might be good. My marriage might be very good. My love for my children might be very good. A particular experience of the sun setting, and it's very beautiful. Those are good experiences. But somehow I want it extra. I want that to totally fix me. So it's inordinate. It's not proper to it. Distorted desire is what these people called a habitus. It's a habit. It's not a passing emotion, but a deeply rooted structure. And the mind becomes totally organized around it. And so everything is real only in terms of this distorted sense of pain and pleasure and the way the world is going to give me that or threaten me. And the important thing here is that contemplatives watch their mind. And they try and notice when negative emotions arise, and they try and deal with it. So if I'm someone who has a bad temper, I try and notice when the anger begins to arise. And I try and strategize about ways to soften it, to disempower it. Or if I'm someone who's very afraid, and I feel that wave of terror coming over me, I try and notice it and disempower it. And those are very important and powerful methods. However, they don't speak to the deeper level that actually before an emotion or experience or pops into my consciousness, my whole mind is already absorbed into these patterns and structures. And they all, they're synergistic. So my fear turns into anger, which turns into the desire to relieve that through pleasure, the objectification of other people. And it translates into social patterns that reflect those things. Patriarchy, economic imbalance, racism, etc. So the microcosmic me, mine, fear gets extrapolated into the macrocosm. So inside myself and outside myself, there's a huge interlocking set of patterns. And the complexity for a contemplative or for every person.
Mm-hmm.
So the difficulty is in part that we can see things on our consciousness and try and deal with them. But that's like the iceberg. It's just the tip of it. The real problem is beneath our awareness. And trying to get to that huge iceberg that we can't see exactly is very difficult. And from these writings, one of the things they really emphasize is the way that even as we try to do that, our mind lies to us. So I'll give you an example. The metaphor that they often use is the devil appears to us as an angel of light. So let's say I'm a good practitioner. I fast all day. I say my prayers. I chant. If you put the little brain thing on my head, it would just be perfectly concentrated. But I become very judgmental. I become very harsh to people who aren't as good as I am at my fasting because I'm such a magnificent faster. I'm so awesomely wonderful in my fasting. So that even as I... So that... And I think of this as a good thing. I think I'm a religious person. I'm doing good. And that when I look at Mathieu and I say, you're not fasting as well as I am. You're a bad person. And I think this is a good thing for me, that I need to scold him and I need to be harsh. So the devil, so to speak, has come to me as an angel. It's tricked me. I'm now using my religious practice to simply reify my hostility, my hatred, my anger, my sense of pride, etc. So even as we're, because this deep structure, you know, this iceberg, I'm looking at the little things on top, anger and so on, it's still shooting up all of this distorted mental patterning. So that makes it even more difficult. We can't see it, and things disguise themselves. So we think we're doing the right thing, and we're actually just acting out of our own egocentrism still. Now, one thing that the women contemplatives emphasize in a way many of the men contemplatives do not is that there are lots of ways our mind can cripple us and can disempower our capacity for love. And some of the ways our mind can be disempowered is because we're afraid. It's not just that we're very prideful. It's that we're afraid, or that we're very anxious, or that we lack self-worth. This is the issue that came up this morning. Teresa of Avila says to her sisters about contemplative prayer, and she's saying, this is the devil talking to you, so to speak. We wouldn't say devil anymore. That's an anachronistic metaphor, of course. But these negative mental patterns will say, oh, who am I to practice such a high thing as prayer? Am I just being selfish? What will people think of me? And you have all of these reasons why you shouldn't do this. And they're not prideful reasons. I'm not a good enough person to do this. And Teresa says, how many sisters have the demons assaulted this way through this false humility? So in these different strands of the contemplative tradition, different strategies are necessary. So as Mathieu said, you have 10,000 or however many antidotes.
84,000.
So if your problem is a kind of arrogance, you need one kind of strategy to try and soften that. But if your problem is, I'm just an uneducated woman, who am I to say anything? I'll just sit and be quiet. I'll let you big, important men talk. That's another kind of distortion, and it needs a different kind of antidote. And the women contemplatives in their writings, they write much more about how to work with this lack of self-confidence. And they talk a great deal about how to work with people who are persecuting you. They don't write so much about lust or anger. They write about that hardly at all. But they write a lot about how do you deal with people who are persecuting you? How do you, with a way of real integrity, not just, oh, I'm a good Presbyterian, so I forgive everybody, but with real depth and integrity to feel love and care for people who are actively harming and persecuting you. They write that about, you know, what are the strategies for that, to move that really, really deeply into you? This analysis that's very ancient, I think, speaks to us in our moment of cultural alienation, and that we're in a period of cultural alienation that magnifies some of these things. Our forms of work and pleasure, and we've talked about this, education, the media, the consumer culture, etc. All of these things are terrible assaults on us. You know, even to be in the human condition is to live in this terribly vulnerable way. But we live in a period of enormous cultural suffering. And so in my country, there's a lot of wealthy people and affluent people, and all of that affluence is sucking resources out of the land and other cultures. But we're not happy. We're more miserable than ever. So there's a suffering even in our supposed wealth and so on and so forth. So our context of this acute cultural alienation, in addition to this basic human problem, I would just hypothesize, and maybe the spirit of it, because attention to society, really creates an increased vulnerability to addictive ways of relating to everything. So we don't just work, we're workaholics. It's not just that I want that academic award. I have to have it, and I have to have a lot more. And security, relief. So in other words, we live in this heightened situation of cultural suffering, which makes us much more vulnerable to forms of relief that are actually very destructive. So I'm just going to say a couple of things about analogies. I can't decide whether these are analogies or whether addiction is just an intensified version or a different version of this basic mental structure. I can't decide. So you all maybe can illuminate me. But the ways in which these things seem to have similar structures is that the mind is hidden from itself. It's not transparent to itself. It lies to itself. It's confused. So you have this confused mind that makes it really hard to get. If you're in the woods and it's dark and misty and you can't see the path, it's even harder to get out of the woods. You attach to an object that you think will bring you happiness and relief, but it doesn't. It's a lie. And yet you can't unpin from the hope it will relieve you. And this attachment to these false objects of relief and happiness are self-destructive. They're alienating. They undermine our relationship to one another and in our society. Genuine forms of happiness and goodness become more and more obscured. And we are in bondage to that. We no longer can say, you know what, I'm not going to be angry anymore. Or I'm not going to be egocentric anymore. We're held, and these traditions use metaphors like slavery, bondage, tyranny. We are not free simply to act otherwise. And these habits are embedded in our bodies, not just in our minds. So these things seem to be parallels between the two, if they are two. So here we are as addicts to our human condition, trapped in a golden cage. So I'm going to turn and think about in this unhappy situation, what are ways Christians have talked about disempowering these destructive habits? Abba Mios says to a soldier who comes to say, is there any possibility of mercy for him? A Roman soldier has come to talk to the Abba. And Abba says, tell me, my dear, if your cloak were torn, would you throw it away? Oh, no, he replied. I would mend it and wear it again. The old man said to him, well, if you care for your cloak, will not God show mercy to his own creatures? This is a very important idea in these contemplative parts of Christianity, that there's nothing so desperate. There's no human being so miserable, so despicable, so horrible and degraded, that the mercy doesn't hold it. And ultimately provides some healing. We don't see healing in the world, but from a Christian perspective, and we don't really have a vivid idea about what happens when we die. From a Christian perspective, we can be completely confident that this great mercy holds us. And that is, in a way, one of the root practices. You know, how do you begin to break the pattern? And from a Christian point of view, it's to cling to this confidence that the ultimate reality is compassion. And that little spark, the opposite kind of spark, can become inflamed. So from a Christian perspective, it's desire, healthy desire, that casts out distorted desire. And the healing of desire is by transforming it into love, which will be an antidote for craving and anxiety. So Teresa of Avila says, let us realize, my daughters, that true perfections consist in the love of God and of our neighbor, and the more nearly perfect our observance of these two commandments, the nearer to perfection we shall be. This mutual love is so important for us that I should like you never to forget it. So this is the core. This is what we think about day and night, and which is the root of all practice. Because craving or distorted mind is so, so deeply rooted, you have to have synergetic practices to unlock it. One thing won't do it. You have to have lots of ways of engaging it. And I'm just going to, in a sense, quickly march through a few. I'm not going to spell them out, but just to flag some examples. One is to watch the mind, and there's a way in which this is a very root practice. Is watching the mind is something you do in meditation in a particular way, but in these traditions, watching the mind is something you do all day, every day. You constantly watch the mind. Evagrius Ponticus says, if there is any monk, we might add any person, who wishes to gain experience in monastic art, let him keep careful watch over his thoughts. Let him observe their intensity, their periods of decline and flow as they rise and fall. Let him note the complexity of his thoughts, their periodicity, the nature of their associations. Then let him ask Christ the explanations of these data he has observed. So on the one hand, you're watching your mind. But in watching your mind in the Christian tradition, you're integrating that watchfulness with the divine presence. So the divine presence is woven into your consciousness all the time. Another practice, of course, is meditation. Meditation, probably don't have to say much about that. There's Christians have a lot of different techniques for meditation. Visualization, centering prayer, chanting the Psalms is a very root practice. Mantra recitation, imageless meditation, divine reading. Evagrius Ponticus says that to pray without images is the perfect prayer. But meditation usually implies some effort or technique. Contemplation, this is the part that's least valuable for secular ethics. But from a contemplative point of view, this is really what unlocks the tyranny of egocentrism. And that's when the mind simply dwells in reality. It simply dissolves. And our word for that is a kind of dissolution into love. Love can imply something reified or substantial. We would say in the Christian tradition that there's no image, no thought, no construct, no paradigm, no language, no set of symbols that could in any way adequately connect to the divine reality. So we have all kinds of images like abyss or something for the divine reality and its non-duality. The manifest form of divine reality is love. Love is still an expression, something concrete. It's a word, it's a concept, it's a feeling, it's a disposition. But it's this integration of the manifest and the unmanifest that really unlocks the power of the ego, the distorted power of the ego.
I say I love him, but I lie.
Yes.
For I'm not Sarakasuto.
How do you explain this?
What is the meaning?
What's the meaning?
For I'm not. What was the meaning?
How do you
just love?
Yeah.
Oh God.
I'm sorry.
How do you interpret the last part? For I'm not. Does it say I do not exist because I'm love?
I, the will.
I does not exist.
Annihilated. So she's expressing this paradox where as a conscious being with thoughts, to the extent that we have thoughts and we express them, Marguerite says, I love him. I love the divine. But she says, I lie. Because to say words, to say him, to say I, to say love is a distortion. So you want to speak, so you say I love him. But to say that is a lie. None of those things exist. So there's a manifest and unmanifest form. I am not. So for her, the whole practice is annihilation. But the fruit of annihilation is this spacious love, this totally spacious love, especially for enemies.
That's more or less the same sort of approach. Ultimately, no I, no God, even no God. That's what Buddhist people went now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we must protect from nihilism.
Yeah.
That's the culture.
So how... Because, you know, this line of approach, there are parallels in the Buddhist tradition. So then how do you guard against falling into nihilism?
I think in the Christian tradition, the guard against nihilism is love. Because it's not simply nothing. I mean, this is...
God, the absolute, independent. The God's creature... It exists.
So in this kind of non-dualistic understanding that you're presenting, so, you know, how do you guard against nihilism? Because God is absolute, so there is still something.
God
and
is God, absolute?
God's creature, since the creature also created by God. That absolute. So we also have some part of absolute.
We are created in the divine image. That's what we say.
Oh, that's right.
But the divine reality is without image.
Right.
So.
Really, God, your work. Kind of something reality.
But God is still real. It's the absolute ground.
We are not talking, you see, with physical or not. No, doesn't matter. But God is there.
The trace of God, the reason we say God is there, and why we say we are not nihilistic, is that the fruit of it is love.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at love, and we think love has a source or a cause.
Mm-hmm.
The source of that, we name that source in the Christian tradition God. But God has no structure like anything
that's
in creation.
That's right. Huh?
So it's not as if God were a thing or a person or a being.
That's right.
In the Christian...
God formless, yes. Formless.
Yes.
Ultimate truth.
So in the Christian tradition, the mental habit that is hard to break is that our word for what is ultimately true seems reified. So we...
Mingzang, we have talked to
you. Lari nam, tapi ini kan dah kunci tisu besar kan. Tapi orang kita dah isu sama itu nanti mari. Tapi nanti isu cuci nanti betul tu. Tapi tangan tu nasi beri nasi. Ini kan dah jangan tu. Tukun tu perlu cek dia sama orang tu. Siapa yulan juga kerja lo yulan juga dah sama jadah. Tanya nanti apa yang sedih tu tu nih kopi ke. Jika susu juga dah cukup cepat cair cair saja. Jangan tu. Tapi kita ada
perlu sengsam betul susu itu cukup.
So you're talking about a kind of non-dual way of being.
Right. So we say, there's an old folk song, Jesus is on the main line, tell him what you need. And so you say that, and you say, of course Jesus isn't on the main line. That's ridiculous. Or you say, God is Father. You say, of course God's not a father. God doesn't have a body. Or you say, God is a rock in a weary land. God's not a rock. Or you say, God is infinite. Or God is eternal. But then you say, well, of course, eternal, that's just a word. So on the one hand, you say, well, of course these words aren't literal, but your mind is still structured that way. Your mind is still captured by the habit of attributing to God an existence kind of like ours. So even when we say, of course Jesus isn't on the main line, really. Of course God isn't really a rock in the weary land. Of course God isn't really eternal. Your mind is still structured, so it can't think outside the structure of dualistic thinking. So the challenge is to take apart that mental habit. But when you take apart that mental habit, there's nothing to say, because everything we say is structured by that habit. But the Christians don't think of that as nihilistic. Now, it's not nothingness. When you've taken apart the mental habit of concept and reification, we don't think that's nihilistic because...
May I understand the Buddhist philosophers view also, you see, nothingness. But if we remain there, then there is a danger of nihilism. So the positive side also, you see. So therefore, you see, concept of true truth. So nihilism kaya not korva.
So his holiness metasayas
korva. Other
His holiness is drawing the parallel, because you see something parallel happening in the Buddhist thought as well. So when you approach the ultimate nature of reality, you start deconstructing all the concepts and identities and so on, and you end up in kind of a nothingness. But then if you just stay there, you fall into nihilism. So how do you guard against nihilism? Then the reality is restored by invoking the notion of conventional truth. So that's why Buddhism speaks of the ultimate truth and the conventional truth. So His Holiness...
Or from the middle way,
point of view would be emptiness and dependent origination. So the emptiness is the the empty, kind of emptying part, and dependent origination is the reconstruction of reality out of that. So he was asking what would be the equivalent of that in this particular Christian contemplative tradition.
So some kind of safeguard.
Yeah, some kind of safeguard against, you know, falling into nihilism.
The Christian safeguard is a little different. The Christian safeguard...
Yes, there must be, of course, different. So that's why I'm asking you.
The Christian safeguard is to say that the fruit of that deconstruction of concept is the birth of love. So that there's something inherent about the generation of love out of imagelessness. So it's not as if there's imageless reality and the world in its created or interdependent, dualistic, it's a conventional form coming into being, passing out of being, et cetera, et cetera. It's not so much that they're those two things. It's that this whatever we can't have a word for, this non-duality, has an efficacy. The efficacy is love. And that love completely is infused throughout all reality. So that this world that we live in is both itself, you know, material and problematic and beautiful and coming into being and falling out of being and seeming to promise us things it can't give us, etc. It's the way it is. It's also this infusion of the divine love. So from a contemplative point of view, what you want to do is rest in imagelessness so that your mind gets retrained. It has a different structure to it. So that then when you dwell in this world, in this body, in this person, walking around, seeing the stars, seeing how beautiful they are, you see them for what they really are.
So am I right in understanding that what you're saying is that the contemplative's task, if we can call it, is to just do the deconstruction and then remain in this, arrive at the state of non-duality, kind of formlessness, and just dwell in it. And then what comes out of this is the expression of this true love.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you re-engage with the world, your experience is fused with that. So there's a kind of a qualitatively different way of engaging with the world. So His Holiness was saying that this is similar to, you know, in the Buddhist idea that when you dwell deeply on the emptiness of phenomena and when you deconstruct all our reified kind of projections and realize emptiness, and then you re-engage with the world, you perceive the world in a kind of an illusion-like character. So from within this formless state, non-dual state, when love arises,
After that, right?
From as a consequence, you say it's the fruit. Will that love have any kind of directedness, or is it just a pure state of love with no particular directedness? I mean, would it have a structure like an object to whom you love?
Yeah, love to a sentient being. So
love towards other sentient beings. So there is a kind of a directedness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm being urged here to get on with it, but...
go ahead. But I'm just thinking this next slide speaks to that.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. The fourth practice that is very important in this tradition is compassionate action.
Mm, yes.
So actually concrete actions to care for the sick, to care for the poor, to care for to prostitutes, to the disenfranchised, to the grieving, to whoever. So that actual actions with another person, very, very crucial practice.
Which one is Christ in us?
That's right. Mm. So that you've kind of, you're trying to get your ego out of the way so this love can flow through you, so that you can see. From a contemplative tradition, Jesus was really stupid about something we're really smart about. We're really good at saying, oh, you're a woman, you're not as smart as me. Oh, you're African-American, you're probably a drug addict. Seeing social differences and seeing not a person, but seeing the role, the social. We're really, really good at that. Jesus was like he was retarded. He couldn't see that. But he was really good at seeing what's hard for us. Everyone he saw was the bearer of the divine image. He didn't say, oh, you're a prostitute. Oh, you're this or that. He'd say, oh, you are a Christ bearer. You're the divine. Hmm. And he reacted to them just like that. So when we are able to be compassionate with one another and see whoever's in front of us or the whole world, then that's Christ in us. That's what Christians would say. And I need to finish here.
That's fine. That's good.
So in a sense, it's remember who you are. Remember who you are. This set of preoccupations. Oh, I'm Wendy. I'm anxious about this. I want that. I need a new shawl. Here I am in Darmstadt. I have to buy a shawl. That's really important. No. I'm a throne of peace. I'm a sea of joy. So it's remembering who you are. And I want to conclude by saying thank you. And I want to say thank you to the whole lineage of contemplatives who stand before. And I want to say thank you to this conversation between Buddhism and Christianity, which has been so helpful and life-giving.
Mm. Beautiful.
Wonderful.
Huh. Beautiful.
Thomas Merton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. So now you may ask a question if you wish, in addition to saying thank you of His Holiness, if there's something on your heart.
In the desert tradition, when a seeker would go and look for the Amma or the Abba, they would go to the master and they would say, give me a word. So I'm going to say, can you give us a word?
I
think remember him.
Yes? You remember him?
No, no, he's only saying the word would be remember Thomas Merton.
I see.
Remember Thomas Merton.
Good.
Actually, the last my birthday in South India, I expressed the best gift for me on birthday is those person who love me. Please think when you develop about anger, then think me. Mm. And visualize my face. Mm. Mm. I mentioned that. Mm-hmm. Mm. So, and recently, those Burmese Buddhists, so some sort of harassing or harming Muslim community. Mm. Again, I express those Buddhists should think face of Buddha. Mm-hmm. If Buddha there, he definitely mm-hmm. project those poor Muslims. Mm-hmm. So I always see, often you see, when I saw this person's face, I always remember all the real teaching of Jesus Christ. There are similarities. Mm-hmm. And particularly monastic sort of
tradition.
A tradition. And I always consider him as a very, very solid, strong bridge between Buddhism and Christianity. Wonderful person. Mm. His certain death is, I think, great loss. Then, when I look my own picture there, and that time I'm much younger. So that reminds me impermanence. Yes.
Thank you both so much. So Wendy, that was beautiful. We were all touched by it very much. So I think, and in some ways, I hesitate to ask this question because it cuts into the elegance of the argument you presented. But is it too much to ask you to think about how this might extend to our current secular situation? At one point you said, one of your points, you said this doesn't really apply to secular ethics, but as you think about these, particularly these women that you've studied, what can we take from them to help us in our time?
I think if you're a Christian of a certain stripe, at least, you think of this in religious terms. But if you're not, I teach undergraduates, you know, who can be Muslim or Jewish or Christian or nothing, no religion, I mean. And so when I teach these texts, I don't say, well, you should be a Christian and think like MacTield of Magdeburg. I say, there's great wisdom here. Mm-hmm. You know, this real strong commitment to love and to let love grow in your heart and to love one another with this non-judgmental compassion. My students like that. I think that this particular strand of Christianity, they would be appalled by this word, but we talk about self-compassion. And they don't have an idea of self-compassion. But they do, by thinking about compassion flowing through you, that's very healing and nourishing. It's not self-sacrifice. It's not, I'll give up this and I'll give up that and I'll just let myself be this maimed, exhausted person. It's very empowering, you know, to let compassion flow through you. So it's a way of thinking about your ethics in a way that isn't shameful or... It says, I can be something wonderful. So people who have very low self-worth or are ashamed or compassion, if it moves through you, it touches you too. It's not like some other thing, like other people deserve compassion, but I don't. It simply because it moves in you, it includes you too. And so it's a very different way of thinking than...
Right.
Than a, oh, I'm guilty, I'm, you know, I did bad things, and I, you know, it's a very different thought pattern.
Right. And liberating.
Yeah.
So, sir, Arthur.
Thank you so much. That was terrific. I wonder if you might say something, following up on this, what are the implications for ethics or secular ethics, that kind of a thing. You know, Marguerite Poiret says, I say to the virtues, I take leave of you forevermore.
Mm-hmm.
I am free at last. I go from the small church to the great church.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that? You know, what is she freeing herself from? You know, we talk about the ethics of restraint, the ethics of virtue, and then the ethics of altruism. This is the pattern in the book that we've been studying. And I teach this text also. And this is such a liberating moment. And then what's the reaction of society to this woman and this sequence of liberation and freedom that she experiences, just as a kind of model?
Perret says, Marguerite says, she leaves the virtues. And there were those who did not appreciate her saying that. I think she's saying a couple of, at least two different things.
What period we're talking about?
She was burned in 1310.
She was burned at the stake.
One thing she's saying to her fellow sisters, her fellow contemplatives, there is a sense that you had to practice very harshly. You had to really torture your body. And you had to do that because you're a sinful being. And so if you tortured your body enough, you would clean the sin out. And that was virtue. And she says no to that. There's a way in which that's its own self-clinging, clinging to your sinfulness, clinging to your a kind of self-hatred, a kind of it's an emotionally destructive... The devil appearing as an angel of light. If you're a good religious person, you'll flagellate yourself, you'll starve yourself, you'll hate yourself. And she's saying no. So one thing, fleeing the virtues is fleeing that very harsh penitential pattern. But she's also saying fleeing the virtues. Virtues are like, if you're a ballet dancer, you study at the bar and you do your demi-pliés and you do... your battements tendus, and but you don't, if you're a ballet dancer, you have to do those things to be strong. But you don't, if you're a ballet dancer, you don't spend all your time at the bar doing pliés. You want to go and dance. The virtues train you. At their best, virtues train you. They're kind of discipline. They train you. But when you're trained, you don't stay at the bar doing demi-pliés. You dance. If you're trained in the virtues, then there's nothing but love. So you say goodbye to your, you know, your preschool, and you live in love. I obey nothing but love, she says. So I think she means both of those things.
And it was very threatening.
Oh, very. She was destroyed.
So what do we... How do we take that into our current context?
You say, I'm really glad the Inquisition isn't around anymore.
That's all.
So I think the underneath Arthur's question, though, was this idea that We are hoping to develop a secular ethics approach in the contemporary schools that will, among other things, inculcate in young people an ethic of restraint, an ethic of virtue, and an ethic of altruism. Is there some point at which they leave the bar and dance?
Actually, in this literature, it's the other way around. In the beginning of Shantideva, doesn't he say that this like bodhisattva desire comes like a flash of light, and then you get motivated to
not quite.
Nope? Okay, well, we won't worry about that. But in this tradition, it starts with the motivation. It starts with this God intoxication. It starts with a desire, with this little spark of love. And you see the things that are obstacles, and therefore you want to do things to remove the obstacles. In my teaching, when I teach these texts, it's really easy for my students to get excited about compassion and justice and His Holiness's books or Abraham Heschel or Martin Luther King or whoever. That they are excited about that and they're inspired, and it gives them a vocabulary for something in their heart that's not being fed. And then they go out there at Emory, they go out and they get drunk and they, you know, do whatever they do. So there's not much ethic of restraint. But there is a real genuine beginning of an ethic of love. And it would work its way down. So that the more you find this life-giving, the more you're motivated to move the things away that are interfering with it. So actually, to tell you the truth, I know we do talk about this as hierarchical, but in this literature, it moves down. Because it's so sweet. Because the compassion is so sweet. And these fraternity boys who do whatever they do on the weekend. But they read His Holiness, and they read Dorothy Day, and their hearts are really moved. It's sweet. It's not just discipline. It's sweet. And then the other things come organically in a way.
So one of the key points, messages that comes through your presentation from the teachers.
There's the secular ethic on Sujana's work.
So if we were to relate to the secular ethics kind of initiative, two things that are clear. One is the kind of the goodness which is part of the nature. So that is the idea of Christ within us. The other one is how sense of well-being and happiness is ultimately.
Unless we pay more attention about these deeper
values.
If we just let go of these
habitual patterns.
Then there's a problem.
There's a problem.
So that we can apply.
Adapt.
I think that's right.
Talk very, very good for promotion of religious harmony. So now your presentation, also you see,
So one area where your presentation could really bring awareness in the kind of area of inter-religious dialogue and understanding is that generally the understanding is that there is a large degree of commonality when it comes to the teaching of practical ethics, love, compassion, and so on. But in the domain of wisdom, mm-hmm. there is no recognition, at least not much recognition. There could be synergy or connection. But what you're pointing here is that even at the, in the domain of wisdom, mm-hmm. at least in the way in which one perceives the understanding of nature of reality, there could be mm-hmm. at least parallels and similarities. Mm-hmm. Because you are talking about disparity between the actual reality and the how we experience it.
May I say so? If you pay some attention about Buddhist sort of epistemology. Summary with Hanish, she was how we are charged.
So Isolnitz was saying that he was saying that if he may say so, if you take a look at the sophistication of the epistemological language that is found in the Buddhist epistemological tradition, you could even sharpen your presentation.
The part of the Christian tradition where you have that kind of metaphysical sophistication would be in particularly in the Neoplatonic texts that are more philosophical, and there it's very disciplined mentally and profound. But I wasn't sure if everyone in this room would be as interested as I am in Neoplatonic metaphysics. So, but there is that part of the Christian tradition that takes up these epistemological and metaphysical questions. This literature, not so much.
So if we were to somehow correlate your presentation of these the teachings of the mystic tradition within the broad category of Catholicism versus Protestantism, which of the camps you would say these teachings will
This is all before the Protestant Reformation. So it's all
pre-17th century.
Yeah.
Rishad and So the ideas that you are presenting, the mystic tradition, like the non-dualism and so on, in today, in contemporary Christian world, is it sort of more predominant in the Catholic tradition or in the Protestant tradition?
And then also some, I think, very, very ancient sort of Christian tradition, I think Syrian Christian.
Coptic
Christians. And also Egyptian.
So is there any connections with the Coptic Christians?
Not the Coptic so much. Isaac of Nineveh is a little, kind of in that neighborhood. Nineveh is not technically in Syria. I know that. But it's more in that family.
Family, okay.
Of Christianity.
Yeah. And the desert. Syria, but the desert is further as well from Egypt,
Egypt and Palestine.
But the lineage is alive anywhere in current contemporary Christianity?
I'm sitting here right now.
Are you alive? Or are you a distortion of reality?
Definitely that.
No, right. So, yes, you are keeping it alive, and it's alive in your students, and it's alive in your heart.
It was suppressed.
It was radically suppressed.
This has always been a small river of Christianity. The authority structure of Christianity moved out of this contemplative center into an ecclesial structure that became very authoritarian and very interested in power dynamics and very terrifying. And it needed a theology to hold those things up. So Christianity becomes very distorted, and this tradition is a huge threat to it. So it's always hidden away. It's a small part of Christianity. It's always been a small part of Christianity, but it's always been alive.
Jinji than the injury than the Julian of Norwich, the England. Julian of Norwich is from England, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Julian of Norwich is from England, yeah.
And what should we make of the fact that it seems to be carried predominantly by women?
I don't think it's carried. I think it's carried by men and women.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah.
In the medieval period, really?
Sure, Meister Eckhart and John of the Cross.
You would fall into this, put them in this category.
Yeah. Okay.
John Main category.
Paul other than Benedictine. In the Saint John the Cross said the Dominican.
Carmelite.
He met in Oxford. Yeah. So on the Dolinji got the young dog called the Shiva Puchemazon, now Tombos. His Holiness was exposed to some of the teachings of the Saint John the Cross at one of the colleges, the Dominican College in Oxford, and there was some participation from some scholars from the Carmelite tradition.
Yeah, that would be his tradition. Mm-hmm.
So, Mathieu, we said today is our day to have these two remarkable traditions, and how do you take this in?
I would like to try to reconcile the two drilling Buddhist practice and D2 receptors.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, you mentioned rightly so that in a self-centered attitude, when you get a tooth drilling, basically you become really, really, really important. And then Nora mentioned how the fact of opening to others, you know, could be helpful. And I think also you all mentioned in order to alleviate the craving and possibly help us to get out of it. So there is actually a Buddhist practice that allows you, and it is applied both to tooth drilling and to craving, because sometimes it's physical pain, sometimes it's mental afflictions. And to link it with compassion and not being completely in the tooth drilling. And of course it's again, typical Buddhist practice. Everyone knows it here. I don't know how much we can secularize it. To some extent, possibly, but it's worth thinking of it. So it's basically try to think that when I suffer like this, first of all, there are many other sentient beings who have similar suffering. That's one. And then to think, well, you know, my suffering, it's very little dimension and meaning and scope, and it's always focusing on me. So how could I imbue that with something greater than that, which is compassion? So what it would be the way to do that? So we use a meditation that is based on breathing and visualization. So we think that there are many other beings who suffer of tooth drilling. And so when you breathe out whatever leftover of happiness are with you when you are in tooth drilling, you send it to all those sentient beings who suffer tooth drilling and pray that may to this they be relieved from that tooth drilling, and may my, and then when you breathe in, you sort of extract their suffering and say, okay, I'm suffering a lot from that tooth drilling, but may that stand for all the suffering of others. You exchange giving your happiness and taking the other's suffering. So we do that with physical pain, and I know it's a very profound and common practice. And one of Kensei Rinpoche's nephew, who was a great Gelugpa master, Gen Menla, he wrote to Kensei Rinpoche that as he was dying, that he was doing this practice of taking up suffering and giving happiness. And then when you take suffering, it's not like a further burden, actually it's transformed, and kind of joy of relieving the suffering. So now, we don't only do that with a physical pain. The next step is also, if I suffer from hatred, from craving precisely, so I'm really, under the burden and the affliction of the weight of craving, so at least may, by doing this exchange, whatever happiness I have, and extract the craving of other beings when you breathe in, add it to yours, so at least it's good for something, that my craving may stand for all the cravings in the world, and so that they are free from it. And by doing so, instead of making it heavier, it makes it much lighter because it's imbued with compassion. So constantly doing that is a very powerful practice. I don't know how much we can secularize, but somehow it ties up, you know, being coming a little bit out of your me, me, me. Mm-hmm. And it can be applied to a strong mental affliction, because the stronger they are, the stronger they may wish that that may stand for enormous amount of others being craving. So it gives, it imbues it instead of being self-centered entirely at other centers. And it, I don't know whether that approach might have any help, but certainly in Buddhist practice is considered to be very powerful.
Hmm. Is there anything like that?
There is a cognate in a way. One of the things that particularly the women talk about is participating in Christ's suffering, and so that their suffering and Christ's suffering become united, and Christ's suffering is understood to be compassion for all the world. So you, in a sense, move your suffering into the divine nature, and in moving it into the divine nature, you infiltrate the suffering of the world with divine power. You participate in the divine compassion, and you move that compassion throughout the world. So in a sense, it's similarly wanting to dislocate your attachment to your own suffering and connect it to the compassion for all humanity. But the way these women in particular did it was by thinking of participating in the divine compassion as the way to move into universal compassion.
Sarah, could you get the microphone? I want to ask you, sort of bringing this into the world a little bit. We're going to hear from you tomorrow, and we're all looking forward to it very much, about the program you're leading, which uses techniques from contemplative practices, mostly in the Buddhist tradition, as I understand it, to help people who are struggling with alcoholism and alcohol abuse. So I sort of have two questions. One was, Mathieu just described this and said he didn't know if it could translate into the secular tradition, and you would have a good sense of that from your interactions with your clients. But also, you've had a lot of time to talk to Wendy this week and think about what she's bringing. Are there ways in which this perspective that she's bringing to us deepens or enriches or changes the way you think about how you'll be doing your work?
I'm struck by the parallels, and we've talked a little bit about this. I just find it so heartening that these different disciplines and wisdom traditions are landing on similar truths. Today, listening to you, I was struck by the iceberg, you know, the sense of this tip of the iceberg and all that's underneath it, that's sort of the driving force in many of our lives and the way that our minds and lives are structured that we're not seeing, and the dangers of that, and how we can bring awareness practices again to kind of lower the level of the water so that we can see more of what's actually driving this chip. When you were talking about the tendency to ascribe value to objects and relate to the world in terms of things that I want that are going to make me happy or push away things that are going to, you know, cause me suffering, and seeing that tendency, just the transformative power of just seeing that tendency, and then very much struck by the potential and power of allowing ourselves to get out of the way and allow a greater power of compassion to come through, including ourselves, as you said, and that these practices can be very, in my perhaps ignorant, probably ignorant view and somewhat clunky way, can be secularized and brought to populations and languaged in ways that are very simple. And there's such basic truths that I think that's evident by seeing how they're manifesting in these different traditions. And so there's such a basic, simple truth, not easy necessarily, but simple truth that I think can absolutely be languaged in a way that's accessible to everyone. Yeah.
When I teach meditation, I don't use, even if I'm teaching to Christians, I don't use language of God, or I don't even often use the divine, because many Christians or non-Christians have the idea of their head of a really not very nice God. So it's it just pulls up images that aren't helpful. So even if I'm teaching students who are of various traditions, I just use images like light, like compassion is a light. So try and find languages that are, you know, images that are not religious languages, but make compassion almost tactile, not something you're willing into existence, but something that it's like a light that's in you and that just you can effortlessly radiate from you because it's who you are fundamentally. So you can use that kind of language without using religious language.
And one of the great opportunities we have now in many of our universities around the world is the increasing diversity of the student body. So they come from many different faith traditions, mm-hmm. some deeply embedded in a tradition which they've brought to college, some less so and eager to learn more about it as they interact with other students who express curiosity about their tradition and they realize that mm-hmm. they don't have a very good account of it. Mm-hmm. So there's a very sort of rich exchange that can mm-hmm. happen. And I think that's encouraging if we think about this goal of trying to enlarge our circle of concern to all beings. Vivica.
I think I'm taking it in a little bit different direction, and it's actually both addressed to you, Wendy, and to Mathieu, because especially you, Mathieu, were talking about motivation also in your talk this morning. And I think you're talking about also motivation yes. Into this journey of training the mind or practicing. And I think from the studies I've been doing in drug treatment facilities as a social scientist, not as a clinician, but looking at what's going on in the treatment facilities, there's a lot of talk about motivation. And sometimes motivation is thought of as something that's inside the person. Well, he or she is not motivated enough to be in treatment, and that's why he or she drops out of treatment. Or we have to work with motivation so we can motivate this client or patient to stay in treatment and progress. And motivation sort of becomes a black box in treatment that if that sort of works, then treatment can work also. When we look at when I've been looking at what's going on in treatment facilities in practice, and I think that I guess that the motivation to go into this journey can, you know, when does that spark come or how does it come? That's one thing, but also how does it sustain? I guess a lot have experienced that practicing is not that easy. and you might not get what you really want or have read in your books or heard from your teacher. Just if there were some reflections around or if you could elaborate a bit.
When we speak of motivation in Buddhist terms, it's really the intention. And what you speak motivation, of course, we use it also in English, but we call it more determination and perseverance. So motivation is really what sense to give the direction. You go this way or this way. Are you going selfishly or altruistically? And then the determination is how much energy or perseverance or effort, a joyous effort you put into that. So they're slightly different. I think you had something to say.
Well, and so how does these first words, intention, perseverance, attention, effort, sound like work? But then finally, it's joyous.
So in Buddhist term, motivation yes. is the reason why you do that.
Yes.
The goal that you have.
You're holding.
So it's an intention. And then the rest is the journey.
Right.
So in the intention to travel, and the actual travel will be done through effort, to determination. That's what you also part of being motivated means to keep that constant determination along the way as you travel.
So, and I think I heard you say when you spoke of your students, So they read His Holiness, mm-hmm. they read other texts that remind them of what it truly matters to them, mm-hmm. that's being neglected in their education, that they're not seeing mm-hmm. around them in their interactions. And that's a spark of inspiration. Mm-hmm. So the motivation begins in the inspiration. And I think you're saying that too, in a way, aren't you? The intention is really inspiration.
We speak of two aspects of that bodhicitta, you know, the wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of the beings. One is an aspiration.
Right.
It's like preparing for the journey.
Right.
And that would be altruistic. Right. And then the actual journey is the active sort of bodhicitta and implies practicing, you know, generosity, discipline, and patience, and effort, and right. and concentration, and wisdom, and so forth, right. and patience. Yes. So that becomes the active part, yes. Right.
And then what happens when the inspiration wanes, if it does?
I think in this perspective, it's a little different. And maybe if one's dealing with people in great life difficulty, a lot of emphasis on self-discipline and a goal. I have a goal here, and if I do these certain things, I reach it. In this tradition, it's more like some immediate experience of sweetness. So even if someone looks at a client with genuine care and love, so that they suddenly have this feeling of being loved, this tiny spark of experience of goodness. And you have that little taste of goodness. You want to make it bigger. And then you're motivated. But it's different from, I have an objective, and if I do these... It's like when you get a PhD, if I learn German, and then I do this, and then I do that, and then this other thing will happen. It's more like, I tasted what it was like to love someone. I tasted what it was like when I just did this simple act of compassion. And that taste was sweet to me. So now I want to keep it up.
Your Holiness is nodding your head. Yes, yes. Nora, yesterday you mentioned that you'd grown up in Mexico and knew something of...
In Christianity.
Yes.
Or my brain is a jumpy brain, and what you said immediately jumped into the concept of... That I don't think it's gratuitous that you're using the word is sweet. Sweet is sugar. Sweet mm-hmm. is actually hedonic.
Right.
Sweet
right.
is
right.
dopamine.
Yeah.
Dopamine.
That's right.
Conditions you. So
yeah.
you do something.
That's right.
Yes.
That gets a dopamine addict.
Yes, I made that.
Provides you an experience that is positive, mm-hmm. and that positive experience is learned, mm-hmm. so you want to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. there you have the dopamine. I didn't link it with the D2
That's
receptors
wonderful.
Because there are many receptors,
yeah,
but
right.
I'm linking it with dopamine and condition.
Wonderful.
That actually, I think it was maybe when Mark was talking and he talked about sweet and dopamine, I can't remember how it went, but I thought that's why in Christianity, the word that the contemplatives use over and over is sweetness, that the divine is sweet. And I thought, then yeah, and immediately I thought dopamine. Not, but it makes sense. It makes perfect sense, and that you could be motivated if something is happening that, you know, in your physiology that makes it possible to continue, not just by a kind of white knuckled will, but because it's good.
Yeah, but and we've spoken a lot of dopamine, but like Ken has very clearly demonstrated. In the aspect of liking hedonic, the endogenous, the opioids mm-hmm. are very important. But what's interesting in making this association is that opioids are also one of the neurotransmitters involved in forming attachments. Mm-hmm. So attachments yeah. to people are pleasurable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They involve some of these opioid mechanisms. Of course, it's more complex than that, but opioids are involved in that transition.
Yeah.
Can I say something?
Please, yeah. You certainly may.
Now I'm speaking in my own voice. I was wondering that, you know, I don't think we need to create this kind of dichotomy of, you know, working from the ground up, from the, you know, virtue of, you know, restraint, ethics of restraint, virtue and altruism, and then top down in the way in which the contemplative tradition that you represent speaks of, you can have a parallel process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, yes. like a lot of people engage into kind of a certain pursuit because they're inspired by something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, they had an experience, they have had a personal experience mm-hmm. of being with someone who embodies the value. So, mm-hmm. for example, like students in the presence of, you know, His Holiness, you know, we want to be like His Holiness. You know, there's a kind of a faith in the form of emulation. And then that experience leaves a particular taste. And then, of course, in order to get there, you need to go yes. work through the steps. So I don't think there is a kind of a dichotomy. It could be, you know, even in the case of one individual, it could be happening both at the same mm-hmm. time.
Yes.
I just wanted to bring that out.
Thank you. Yes. And Matthew and I... And that Matthew and I chatted last night, and that because that is your story, going as a young man, going to India, meeting people, the faces that represented for you something you didn't quite understand, but you knew you wanted. And the faces that you showed at the end of your talk this morning, your teachers, in some ways are such a dramatic reminder for us. Mark showed faces at the beginning of his talk, tormented faces of people who are addicted. You showed these magnificent, beautiful faces, and there are two more here that draw us in this other direction.
In Zen, we have an expression, the taste that turns you around. So what this means is that you have this moment of realization, and it is the spark. It turns you toward practice. It gives you the energy of determination to persist through all the ups and downs of practice. But you are warned that you can't seek that which you just tasted. And this is really, for me, a fascinating detail in the practice, that embedded in the tradition is a caveat. You have the realization, but don't seek it again. Because you didn't seek it in a certain way in the first place. It arose within you. And if you seek it, that is a nemesis. So the craving is averted it's a caveat. It's averted in the Zen process.
That's beautiful.
In this literature, there's also a sense that on the religious path you can get preoccupied with... that you can get preoccupied with religious experience as if that were the thing. And particularly Parad or John of the Cross really emphasize not... Annihilation is annihilation of the will, including this will for...
Repeatability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you're admonished not to seek to repeat the experience.
Because that's grasping and craving. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Repeat much, no? Kung kung marwa.
Did you? It's always saying that there is some repetition involved, though, because otherwise you wouldn't become familiar. So it's a sort of a more nuanced kind of...
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's... when you use the image or the sort of sensory experience of sweetness... and it is a sensory experience, mm-hmm. it's not a conceptual experience. There's an experience in the body that rests within... And it is the taste that turns you around. You have this something. But if you seek it aggressively or with what Suzuki Roshi called a gaining idea, an idea to get something, to get mm-hmm. shamatha or to get enlightened, mm-hmm. no.
Hmm.
dopamine.
So in that sense, there is no desire. There is no aspiration.
Embedded
wanting
throughout the practice,
further progress.
All through the practice, you have the very beginning of an intensive practice. Every day, we cultivate bodhicitta in our way, and every evening at the end, we dedicate merit. In the Zen way. But the kind of seeking or craving process that we've been addressing here, which is also, it's in Zen, we call it the Zen sickness. Mm-hmm. It's when the motivation becomes self-centered for realization.
So we are out of time. It's 3:00. Your Holiness, did you wish to say anything further before we adjourn?
Nothing.
If not, I do want to thank Wendy for your really wonderful presentation.